Chapter 10. The thing that had changed everything was the tranquil basis of my home life. The vagaries of practice went on, and would always go on, but behind it all, Helen's presence was a warm infinity, a measureless peace. When I look back at the time before she was my wife, it was an uncertain world, and events like the Darabee show seemed an eternity ago. I remembered when Siegfried first asked me about it.
"How would you like to officiate at Darabee show, James?" Siegfried threw the letter he'd been reading onto the desk and turned to me. "Well, I don't mind, but I thought you always did it." "I do, but it says in that letter that they've changed the date this year, and it happens I'm going to be away that weekend." "Oh, well, fine. What do I have to do?" Siegfried ran his eye down his list of calls. "Well, it's a sinecure, really. More a pleasant day out than anything else. You have to measure the ponies and be on call in case any animals are injured. That's about it, really. Oh, and they want you to judge the family pets." "Family pets?" "Yes, they run a proper dog show, but they have an expert judge for that. This is just a bit of fun. All kinds of pets. You've got to find a first, second, and third." "Right," I said. "I think I should just about be able to manage that." "Splendid!" Siegfried tipped up the envelope in which the letter had come. "Here are your car park and luncheon tickets for self and friend if you want to take somebody with you. Also your bets badge. Okay?" The Saturday of the show brought the kind of weather that must have had the organisers purring with pleasure. A sky of wide, unsullied blue, hardly a whiff of wind, and the kind of torrid, brazen sunshine you don't often find in North Yorkshire. As I drove down towards the showground, I felt I was looking at a living, breathing piece of old England. The group of tents and marquees vivid against the green of the riverside field, the women and children in their bright summer dresses, the cattle with their smocked attendants, a line of massive shire horses parading in the ring. I parked the car and made for the steward's tent, with its flag hanging limply from the mast. Tristan parted from me there. With the impecunious student's unerring eye for a little free food and entertainment, he had taken up my spare tickets. He headed purposely for the beer tent as I went in to report to the show secretary. Leaving my measuring stick there, I looked around for a while. A country show is a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Riding horses of all kinds, from small ponies to hunters, were being galloped up and down, and in one ring the judges hovered around a group of mares and their beautiful little foals. In a corner, four men armed with buckets and brushes were washing and grooming a row of young bulls with great concentration, twiddling and crimping the fuzz over the rumps like society hairdressers. Wandering through the marquees, I examined the bewildering variety of produce, from stalks of rhubarb to bunches of onions, the flower displays, embroidery, jams, cakes, pies, and the children's section. A painting of The Beach at Scarborough by Annie Hazeltine, age 9, rows of wobbling copperplate handwriting. A Thing of Beauty is a Joy Forever, Bernard Peacock, age 12. Drawn by the occasional gusts of melody, I strolled across the grass to where the Darabee and Hulton Silver Band was rendering Poet and Peasant. The bandsmen were all ages, from 70s down to one or two boys of about 14, and most of them had doffed their uniform tunics as they sweated in the hot sun. Pint pots reposed under many of the chairs, and the musicians refreshed themselves frequently with leisurely swigs. I was particularly fascinated by the conductor, a tiny, frail man who looked about 80. He alone had retained his full uniform, cap and all, and he stood apparently motionless in front of the crescent of bandsmen, chin sunk on chest, arms hanging limply by his sides. It wasn't until I came right up to him that I realized his fingers were twitching in time with the music, and that he was, in fact, conducting. And the more I watched him, the more fitting it seemed that he should do it like that. The Yorkshireman's loathing of exhibitionism, or indeed any outward show of emotion, made it unthinkable that he should throw his arms about in the orthodox manner. No doubt he had spent weary hours rehearsing and coaching his players, but here, when the results of his labours were displayed to the public, he wasn't going to swank about it. Even the almost imperceptible twitching of the fingers had something guilty about it, as if the old man felt he was being caught out in something shameful. But my attention was jerked away as a group of people walked across on the far side of the band. It was Helen with Richard Edmondson, and behind them Mr. Alderson and Richard's father deep in conversation. The young man walked very close to Helen, his shining, plastered-down fair hair hovering possessively over her dark head, his face animated as he talked and laughed. There were no clouds in the sky, but it was as if a dark hand had reached across and smudged away the brightness of the sunshine. I turned quickly and went in search of Tristan. I soon picked out my colleague as I hurried into the marquee with refreshments over the entrance. He was leaning with an elbow on the makeshift counter of boards and trestles, chatting contentedly with a knot of cloth-capped locals, a woodbine in one hand, a pint glass in the other. There was a general air of earthy bonhomie. Drinking of a more decorous kind would be taking place at the President's Bar behind the steward's headquarters, with pink gins or sherry as the main tipple. But here it was beer, bottled and draught, and the stout ladies behind the counter were working with the fierce concentration of people who knew they were in for a hard day. "Yes, I saw her," Tristan said when I gave him my news. "In fact, there she is now." He nodded in the direction of the family group as they strolled past the entrance. "I've had my eye on them for some time. I don't miss much from in here, you know, Jim." "Oh, well." I accepted a half a bitter from him. "All looks pretty cozy. The two dads like blood brothers and Helen hanging onto that bloke's arm." Tristan squinted over the top of his pint at the scene outside and shook his head. "Not exactly. He's hanging on to her arm." He looked at me judicially. "There's a difference, you know." "I don't suppose it makes much difference to me either way," I grunted. "Well, don't look so bloody mournful." He took an effortless swallow which lowered the level in his glass by about 6 inches. "What do you expect an attractive girl to do? Sit at home waiting for you to call? If you've been pounding on her door every night, you haven't told me about it." "But it's all right, you talking. I think old man Alderson would set his dogs on me if I showed up there. I know he doesn't like me hanging around Helen, and on top of that, I've got the feeling he thinks I killed his cow on my last visit." "And did you?" "No, I didn't. But I walked up to a living animal, gave it an injection, and it promptly died, so I can't blame him."